Would you care for something?
No, thank you. This is the second side of the third tape of Maurice Shapiro, and this is a continuation. And you mentioned that you and your family spent some time in London when you were how old?
I was 12.
12, okay.
What year?
1929.
Okay.
There's something wrong there because 29 was a big riot, and that was a summer. I'd have to check on that.
I really don't think.
Well, it's
all right.
You know. Anyway, remember, my parents took me to Palestine in 1919 when I was 2 years old, 2.5. And while they were there in 1919, 20, and 21, I was growing up at the time, and then they came back to the States for a while and then went back to Palestine in 1921 or 22. And my first schooling, both kindergarten and elementary school, were all in Palestine.
But what were some of the fun things that you did more at home, recreation? What were some of the things that you remember that were recreation to you and your community, actually?
Well, the most important aspect of that, of growing up in Palestine, were what are called the youth movements, which were a major aspect of growing up in Palestine. Now, not everybody belonged to a youth movement, but all of my contemporaries did. And they actually had, they were political in nature, too. The non-political were the Boy Scouts. And in a sense, although as a teenager in the Bet Sefer Hareali, which I attended in Haifa, that was part of the school. Most of us did not belong to the Boy Scouts, but we belonged to the youth movement. And these youth movements were really the offshoots, or not offshoots, part of political parties. And the one that I belonged to was of the Labor Party. And their aim was, apart from continuity, we had camps in the summertime where the camps were related of being on the land. The camps would be right next to a kibbutz.
What was the emphasis of those camps?
The camps, half-day work and half-day recreation.
And what kind of recreation?
Tiulim. Tiul in Hebrew means funny how you have difficulty translating. Letayel is to take walks.
So hiking.
Hiking.
Okay.
Right. And organized hikes, and then organized activities such as plays and music and things
like
that.
So there were creative things.
There were creative, but the most creative was working in the vineyards, or working on the other agricultural activities. And half your time was spent at that, because it was to be there. The ones I attended, one was in Kfar Giladi, which is one of the northernmost kibbutzim. It has great historical importance. That was where Trumpeldor was murdered in the 20s. And
who was Trumpeldor?
Joseph Trumpeldor was the hero of the original kibbutzim. The revisionist, the Jabotinsky people, have taken his name, and their youth movement was called Brit Trumpeldor.
Meaning what?
Meaning Brit like Brit Milah, like, you know, that's a circumcision.
Yeah,
you know.
Nice.
Brit is really
not a consolidation.
Well, it's a union.
Okay, so it is a consolidation.
Get the Hebrew dictionary to get the exact translation. And that was a rather remarkable time because at the end of the, when the 2 weeks of this camp were over, a group of the older members decided to have another hike up to the top of Mount Hermon. You have to remember that Mount Hermon at that time was in Syria. And we just proceeded, some 80 of us, and took food with us and started hiking up the slopes of Mount Hermon. I don't know how we got across the border, but we did. And when you get up to the top of Mount Hermon and you look down, if you look down to the northeast, you see Damascus. So we decided to walk down to Damascus. Of course, when we got to Damascus, we were all incarcerated. Not in the prison, but in the Jewish ghetto of Damascus. And I'm not being privy to all the negotiations went on, but then finally we were placed on buses and taken back.
How long were you there?
Palestine, a day.
As a young man, do you remember how beautiful it was?
Oh, yes.
I hear it's one of the most exquisite.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any details?
What, of Damascus?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I've been there at other times with my parents. Not only on this occasion,
yeah.
But the it was at that time, of course, it was a small city, and the Jewish quarter was in very near to the bazaar, so I had known about the bazaar already, and but we were in a sort of walled-in compound near the synagogue, the old synagogue, which I presume still exists.
Your 12-hour experience being incarcerated, was that a fun kind of thing?
Yes, we
sort
took
an adventure.
Yeah, as a teenager, you take it all as
sure.
A joke. You didn't.
How did your parents?
Well, that was the interesting thing, because when we arrived at Rosh Pina is an old settlement at the foot of the mountain that where Safed is located. Safed is on top of the mountain. And this is at the gateway to the Upper Galilee, is Rosh Pina. Rosh meaning head, Pina is corner, so it's the head of the corner between Lower Galilee and Upper Galilee. And we had a very good friend, a physician in Rosh Pina, who was a malariologist. A rather famous one.
What is a
malariologist? A physician who deals with the problems of malaria,
okay,
and malaria
okay.
control.
I've never heard that.
No, I can't think of his name. Get that name. There's more history to that, but anyway, I went to see just to say hello. To the family, because we were rather good friends, because he worked with my father in this malaria control. And the Upper Galilee, I don't know how much you know about this, on the upper side of the Sea of Galilee.
I've not been to Israel. I just know
there's
the map.
There was a swamp, a rather remarkable one, that contained, well, in biblical terms, tigers and even lions, I'm told, existed there at one time. But anyway, it was one of those remarkable wetlands that contained practically everything, but it also contained malaria.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
now, you're... Excuse
me. Well, just to finish that, so when I went to see them, his doctor... he said, well, your parents were here 2 days ago, and they had been to the Hermon before me. And my mother did not walk up. She rode a donkey up the side of the hill. Anyway, that was, and I didn't know that they were going when I went to this camp.
But what was their reaction when they found out that you were incarcerated?
Frankly, I don't remember.
Okay, all right. That was what I...
That was only one among other things.
Since you were only 12 years old, I don't know whether you remember, but since there was a world depression, was that affected at all? I mean, what was the effect in the Middle East? Do you have any recollection of that?
I have no recollection. My recollection happens in 1934 when I came back to the States to enter university.
Right. Okay. What I would like to talk about a little bit now is your education after high school. We know the schools that you attended and your degrees, but we're interested in funding, scholarships, whether you had part-time employment, whatever was involved in acquiring your education.
No. Funding was my parents, practically wholly, other than my working in summertime at jobs, different jobs.
And any honors and awards that you influential professors that led you to choose your career?
The primary one was Dr. Abel Wolman, W-O-L-M-A-N, who just died in February of last year. He was a remarkable individual, born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, who attended Johns Hopkins University in 1910 to 1914, where he got his Bachelor of Arts degree, and then was one of the first students to enroll in the new School of Engineering at Johns Hopkins, and he then in 2 years got an engineering degree.
And what? How did he influence you, just by?
Because when I entered the Johns Hopkins University in 1937, he was my professor.
Okay. We have Anne's maiden name, so that takes care of the courtship and marriage we have. You've been retired since what, 1988?
No, 1982.
82, I'm sorry.
All right, that's all right.
Have you done any volunteer work, or if you have, just give us a description of it?
Yes, well, I'm still a member of the Air Pollution Advisory Committee of Allegheny County Health Department. At the Graduate School of Public Health, I've had assignments since my retirement that are dealing with past activities and discussions in relation to both academic and research. I'm involved in research activities at the School of Public Health. I have attempted and was the founding president of what's called the Association of Teachers in Environmental Health. It has not progressed the way I had hoped it would progress, but nevertheless, I think it will in time.
When you mention teachers, do you mean teachers in the secondary schools
in
the college level?
No, this is in the college level. This is a name which parallels the name of the Association of Teachers of Preventive Medicine.
Okay.
Physicians and medical schools. This would be teachers of environmental health or academics involved in environmental health. Schools of public health and schools of engineering and other institutions where environmental health is taught, where there are environmental health academic and research programs.
ideally, where do you want this? Do you want this in the medical schools, or do you want to keep it in the public?
No, no. The association is of anyone. If there's an academic who teaches environmental health in a medical school, he or she would be, you know, perfectly okay. welcome Fine. To come in. There is a question of whether you need another association or whether this kind of group should become a section within either the Association of Teachers of Preventive Medicine or within, there's another association of environmental engineering professors who are primarily in schools of engineering. And that has not been decided yet, but I think it will in time because this group as an entity has separate problems and separate goals to deal with. And in fact, they're a growing number in the country and the world. And as such, I think deserve, right now they're developing a risk assessment society. Now that is a narrow thing that's a part of in which we're dealing with. Now, if there's place for a risk assessment society, I would think there's place for an association where people would both deal with problems and develop the future activities of this profession in academia.
Now, what I would like to ask you is, since it, for me, the question is relevant, I don't know whether it will be for you. If it isn't, then you won't answer it. The situation in Iraq and some of the possibilities that could occur using energies in different ways so that we possibly would not be quite as dependent on oil in the Middle East, would that affect the environmental?
Oh, without question. I was involved in my return from Australia. There developed, obviously, well, in, you remember the oil embargo in 73,
right.
74, and thereafter the whole question of where energy policy in the United States
right.
was going to. Out of that, there arose the fear that in the Ohio Valley in particular, there would be a mushrooming of new public utility, utility plants, electric power generating plants. Most of them would be coal-fired, and coal-fired plant mean primarily SO2 and other pollutants emitted to the atmosphere.
What is SO2?
SO2 is sulfur dioxide, or
okay.
the sulfurs and the nitrogen oxides, the sulfur oxides and nitrogen oxides. A group in the Middle West primarily, and then Senator Bay in particular, felt that there was really a need for assessing what this would be. And out of that, then he passed a special law in Congress with funding, developed what is called ORBES, O-R-B-E-S, the Ohio River Basin Energy Study. And that was a consortium of universities that were involved in it, from the University of Illinois, at Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois at Chicago, University of Indiana, Purdue University, Ohio State University, University of Louisville, West Virginia University, and then they did not include at first Pennsylvania because we're in the upper part of the Ohio River Basin. It starts here. But then they...
What goes all the way then into the Mississippi?
Yes,
okay.
The whole Ohio
right.
River Basin. And at first, they did not consider health aspects as being one part of this study. But then later on, they did, and that's when they brought in Pennsylvania and brought in the School of Public Health. And I was the University of Pittsburgh representative to this Ohio River Basin Energy Study. And... this was a major undertaking of trying to assess what would happen if energy demand increased at the 1.5 to 2% per year that was projected at that time, and the number of plants would be in there for, you know, the whole aspect. It ranged all the way from what was called long-range transport of pollutants, or the acid rain deposition, an acid deposition problem, to social and economic aspect of dislocation of labor requirements, and what happens when you build a plant and the labor has, the group has to move away, and that kind of situation, to the whole question of the health aspects of energy development. So that I was involved in that very, very much, and still am in that sense. Now, the my sense, appalled sense at the lack of leadership in terms of what this country should be doing now in terms of changing both habits in the sense of profligate use of non-renewable natural resources to the assessment of what energy policy should be now, in the next 5 years, in the next 10, in the next 20 years, is very distressing.
What is your opinion that should be done? What would be your?
Well, my my opinion is that if there ever is to be a peace dividend, for example, that all just take this as an example, that all funding for such things as SDI should be immediately switched over to a funding of a integrated and rational research and energy needs and energy alternative energy sources for the future. That kind of thing is an absolute necessity. The other one would be the real implementation of mass transport, for example, the real implementation of energy conservation in industrial processes. Just as we at the same time need the same kind of thing and the same kind of thought processes involved in waste reduction in any industrial processes that we both existing and for the in future. So that becomes an integral part of whatever research and development and planning that goes on in, for industrial development. These are essential requirements, and any postponement of it is just done at the peril for the next generation.
That's an ecological peril. The threat today?
They're all tied up together, and just thinking about it last night, if instead of writing Fidelity, the president would have really, at the same time that he was sending the troops out, there saying, now you at home have to really join in on this kind of a thing, and now you do A, B, C, D, and then whatever else you think you should be doing, whether it's saving hot water, or whether it's saving electricity, or whether it's saving gasoline, in order to conserve, so that you're really total part of this. And then, in terms of what happens, and our assessment of what happens on that kind of a basis, you would know, you would have immediately pulled the teeth of all of this thing, this horrible spectacle that occurs right now. If you heard yesterday's news, that there was some rumor that went on, and out of that, the price of oil went up $1 a barrel. Now, that translates into billions of dollars overnight, and that is based upon a rumor as opposed to based upon your and my activity and everybody else's activity of doing, in quotes, the right thing. And therefore, you know, there's this kind of spectacle where you're always expecting somebody else to shoulder the burden, and that was that's so evident in this thing that it's criminal. I was going to say pathetic, but it's criminal in the sense that on the one hand you send people who are and do you know what acclimatization takes to live in a desert like that? Under these conditions,
it's almost
for kids who come from Minnesota or from Maine. I mean, it's that, you know, and we had unfortunately we don't have it now, but we had an environmental physiology group at our School of Public Health, which was preeminent, and I'm aware of the kind of studies were done on acclimatization. You can acclimatize. There's no doubt about it.
I thought they were trained on the desert, were they?
Oh,
but
no.
It's not comparable.
Who are the 100,000?
Okay.
Small group went to Egypt for 2 weeks.
So that was the impression that they were trained here in the American desert. Okay.
Some of them were, but not 100,000,
yeah.
And certainly not the reserves. And that's so, and even they. Have trouble.
We're not doing it there.
What,
well,
now?
I'll arrive at that.
That's all my opinion.
Yeah, we're talking about energy and energy resources and energy utilization. The one thing that everybody has to remember all the time is that no matter what you do when you talk about coal or oil, you're talking about a non-renewable natural resource, which in time, sooner or later, will run out. So that whether you're talking about 15 years or 500 years, doesn't matter in terms of the human race. You're going to run out of it, and you'll have to find some other way of obtaining the energy necessary to maintain life. Now, it all derives from the sun to begin with, so that that kind of question, or should you take the oil in the refuge of the North Slope Refuge, or drill along the shores of Florida or along the shores of California, are really begging the question in terms of the total problem.
And long term.
And the long term, the total problem.
Right, okay.
Well, and the kind of balancing that has to be done is of the kind of damage that we know can occur, and that does occur no matter what you do when you drill, versus finding either a conservation ethic that makes you use and not waste energy and still allows you to maintain a standard of living that you like or feel you're entitled to, and I'm not sure we're entitled to it. That's a supposition that you know, is based upon where we are and what we do. Vast majority of the world is not using the same amount of energy we're using per capita per year, and so that I think those are just really, in a sense, harassing questions. They're ones that don't meet the question. Listening to oil executives or to others who now say, well, you've got to open up the North Slope because of this, I think that's nonsense, and that's just trying to take advantage for their own greed. And they're not doing it because it'll allow you and me to drive our car 2 miles longer. It is because they want to make money off of it.
Well, isn't that what this is all about?
Well, of course this is all about, but in terms of responsible government and responsible activity, I mean, people should have a longer view of things. Well, that applies as well to the whole question of how you deal with people. I mean, the spectacle now of all of a sudden, because in a political sense, now I'm not talking about energy for the moment, Mr. Assad is quote, on your side, because he hates Saddam Hussein personally, not because he's any better than Saddam Hussein, you're going to make a friend of him now. And that, to me, is...
But that's war, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure that's war. I think that's expediency. And there's a difference in that. I think in war you have to look at a total thing. I think the lesson of the history of the recent past, namely of making a friend of Saddam Hussein because he fought Iran,
was
fighting
our
Iran.
Then.
He was our friend then. Is should be learned now. I mean, I don't see how anybody can make a friend of Mr. Assad on an expediency basis. And
it was
think
done
of
with
what
Hitler
it,
and Stalin. And, you know,
so
Stalin
that this is
our
this
friend.
Is a that relates to energy as well, in terms of how you deal with current utilization and development of alternative sources and development of a conservation ethic. And it's interesting to me is that in my career, and I participate.